Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with John Dean about the many cases that are in Washington, some of which are heading towards the president and some of the president's men. Of course, John Dean is the ideal person to talk to in terms of all the president's men. He served as Richard Nixon's White House lawyer for 1,000 days before becoming the counsel to the president of the United States. And John Dean was the chief minority counsel to the Judiciary Committee of the United States House of Representatives and also an associate deputy attorney general of the United States. He's written about his White House experience and the Watergate experience in a book, Blind Ambition. He also wrote a recent book, The Rehnquist Choice, The Untold Story of the Nixon Appointment That Redefined the Supreme Court. And his most recent book is, newest book is, Worse Than Watergate, The Secret Presidency of George W. Bush. So there'll be quite a bit to talk about. We'll also be joined by Philip Giraldi, who was for 17 years a CIA operations officer specializing in counterterrorism. He served in Europe and the Middle East. He now works in the private sector doing security consulting, and he writes a column in the American Conservative on international security issues. Philip Giraldi recently expressed concern in his column that those who brought us the war in Iraq, the neoconservatives, are now focusing considerable attention on Iran. And he also noted in that article that Vice President Cheney had tasked STRATCOM, that is the Strategic Planning Group in Doha, to develop a plan of attack utilizing conventional and nuclear forces against Iran. We'll also do an update from Crawford. We're looking to the latest developments as Cindy Sheehan, whose son Casey died in Iraq, and she's at what is called Camp Casey, maintaining a vigil during President Bush's month-long vacation at his ranch in the hot, dusty environs of Crawford, Texas. We'll be joined by Anne Wright, who is there in Crawford. She is a former State Department official who resigned at the beginning of the Iraq War, and she was for 29 years a veteran. She's a 29-year veteran of the United States Army, so we'll be talking to her about not just the how Cindy Sheehan is getting under President Bush's skin, but also how there is rumblings of revolt within the military itself at the highest ranks, where many general officers feel that the United States Army that was rebuilt after Vietnam is now being destroyed by this fruitless and no-win situation that the president has put them in Iraq. I'm speaking with John Dean, who served as Richard Nixon's White House lawyer for 1,000 days before becoming counsel to the president of the United States. And prior to that, he was a chief minority counsel to the Judiciary Committee of the United States House of Representatives and an associate deputy attorney general of the United States. He wrote about his White House and Watergate experiences in a book, Blind Ambition and Lost Honor. He also has written The Rehnquist Choice, The Untold Story of the Nixon Appointment That Redefined the Supreme Court. And his most recent book is Worse Than Watergate, The Secret Presidency of George W. Bush. Let's begin, John Dean, by establishing the difference, if you don't mind helping us out here, between an independent counsel such as Ken Starr and a special prosecutor, because I understand that Fitzgerald doesn't have the powers that Starr had.
Well, he's not even a special prosecutor. He's actually called a special counsel is his formal designation, and he is appointed by the Attorney General and done so under a regulation of the Department of Justice, where the Attorney General has authority to create regulations and what have you. This, they do have in place and have had in place a procedure to create special counsel when it's felt that the department has a conflict. That's what's happened here. We do. John Ashcroft was initially involved and recused himself. His deputy, who's now leaving the Department of Justice, then appointed the special counsel. Now, what is an independent counsel? That was created by an act of Congress, and the special counsel, the independent counsel, was appointed by a three-judge panel selected by the Chief Justice of the United States. and really was independent, although to keep the fiction that he was still a constitutional officer, theoretically the Attorney General could remove an independent counsel for cause. But as I say, it's pretty much a fiction.
Well, but in this case, Patrick Fitzgerald, his appointment came about because of a criminal referral from the CIA about the outing of a CIA employee, Valerie Plame, and it went to the Justice Department. Previously, people like Starr, I think that statute has run out, hasn't it?
It has. There is one independent counsel still in existence who doesn't seem to be able to complete a report. He's been there forever. He actually is a classmate of mine from Georgetown, and he just keeps his status and has been unable to close up his shop, I think maybe for 10 years now.
And is he the residue of the Starr investigation, is he?
No, he's not. He was one of the Clinton administration independent counsels that looked into one of the secretarial posts and found no prosecution, and it's a mystery to me why he can't close up his shop.
Well, he's still being paid, though.
Yes, he is.
I mean, isn't it pretty lucrative? I mean, Starr was pulling down a considerable sum. He also had tremendous, lavish quarters, etc.
With Starr, I think Starr could do better in the private sector than he could government payroll. And actually, he did retain his right to practice law, as most independent counsels do.
Right, but in other words, it's not a kind of pro bono, doing the Lord's work.
No, it's not. Whereas I'd say a special counsel, in this instance, the special counsel, Fitzgerald, is a U.S. attorney out of Chicago, mm-hmm. and he's taken on added work to his normal assignment.
And he's got a pretty full plate in Illinois. He's got the mayor's nervous. He's looking into Democratic cronyism in terms of the mayor of Chicago. Plus, I believe he also nailed some of the Republican governor before that. So he's a pretty equal opportunity kind of.
Well, that's what he has a reputation for being. Just follows the facts, and when he finds a violation, he brings a prosecution, and he doesn't care who it is.
Well, there are rumors expressed by the former United States Senator from Illinois, no relation, but his namesake Fitzgerald, suggesting that he had heard rumors within Republican circles from Hastert, who's also from Illinois, and others, that they weren't going to renew Fitzgerald's position as the U.S. attorney in Chicago.
Well, I hadn't heard those rumors. I did track them down, and I think it is wishful thinking more than rumors. I think it would be so politically damaging for them to let him go at this point in this stage of his investigation, just as his grand jury is completing its work in Chicago on the Plame case, the other cases he's got in Illinois. It would be politically not a very shrewd move for this administration, and it could only be read as an effort to cover up.
Well, is there anything to be then read from or implied in the Deputy Attorney General Comey leaving? He had oversight over Fitzgerald's investigation, or over Fitzgerald in the Justice Department, and he left for a lucrative job at Lockheed Martin.
He just might be very savvy. He could see the handwriting on the wall, and he said, hey, here's an opportunity that doesn't come around every time and every week to get a very lucrative job as a general counsel at Lockheed, and took it up. We obviously don't know what all is involved there, but I don't know if that can be read anyway into the Plame investigation or not.
And what about
and the other thing is, I don't think he's particularly privy to it. While he had general supervision, he delegated all of the powers of the Attorney General to Fitzgerald, the special counsel. Fitzgerald has no reason to report to Comey, so he probably doesn't really know what's going on.
And that's so you can't read into the notion that the new guy, Margolis, is in any way being put a task to find out what Fitzgerald has in the pipeline?
No, I don't think you can read that at all. In fact, I think he'd be foolish to try to do so.
But you better believe, John Dean, that the White House is wondering what's in store.
Well, I'm sure they are, but the other thing is, I think they're smart enough to know that they don't want to play around with finding out at this point because they're going to get involved in an obstruction of justice problem.
Well, what do you think is in store then? Because I know it's speculation, but from what we understand from the federal appeals court judge, what he's indicated to others, that there is a conspiracy against Wilson and his wife.
Well, when I read into two cases, one is the decision by Judge Hogan, the chief judge of the. Of the district court, another classmate of mine and a friend of mine from years past. I haven't talked to him in years. Well, we visit occasionally, but certainly not on anything like this. Is when he decided to hold Judith Miller and initially Cooper in contempt, he said something in his opinion that was quite interesting. He said that there had been a shift in the case based on the evidence that had been presented to the court, and that was the reason he was proceeding with the contempt proceedings. When you read the Court of Appeals decision as well, while Tattell found there was a common law newsman's privilege, if you will, he said based on the evidence that was presented by the special counsel, that he didn't think it applied in this case, that the prosecutor, indeed all three judges on the three-judge panel, said that the evidence made the case. Well, this means that, to me, that there's some pretty powerful evidence out there already that he's accumulated of some kind of serious criminal misconduct, and that's why the case is going forward, and that's why Judith Miller is in jail.
And the reason that, although this has been treated by particularly the New York Times as a First Amendment case, as far as the special prosecutor concerned and Judge Hogan, it seems that the reason they put Judith Miller in jail is because she is not coming clean about what she knows, and they feel that what she knows is key to their case.
Well, her case went to the Supreme Court, as you recall, and
right.
They refused to take it
right.
Because they've ruled on this issue many, many years ago,
right.
And it's been the law of the land for a long time that a news person, in fact, no person, not even a president of the United States, has the privilege of not testifying before a grand jury. There is no special privilege for anybody. When a grand jury wants information, they're entitled to get it, and there are no exceptions.
But so, therefore, isn't it a reasonable conclusion that Judith Miller is covering up for the White House?
Not necessarily. She may well be the source herself.
Right. Well, there's a rumor to that she shopped the story. Yes.
Yeah. I don't know the answer to that.
I see.
It's clear that she's taken a very adamant position that there hasn't been a waiver, even though there's been a broad waiver by people signing a requested waiver of any privilege. But even if the privilege just doesn't hold, there is no such privilege that she's claiming.
And the Supreme Court case that you're referring to, that came out of a journalist, I think, who had knowledge of a drug dealer that he was profiling.
That's right. That's the Brandsburg case.
Right. So given what you mentioned earlier, that there's still a hangover from those many, many independent counsels that looked into, and special prosecutors looked into the Clinton administration, and many argued that that was a form of, in effect, a campaign to limit President Clinton's ability to govern by having every one of his cabinet members investigated. And we know that the genesis of many of these investigations came from the same group of people surrounding Richard Mellon Schaefer, who's a conservative fundraiser and donor to many conservative causes in Washington. The long and the short of it is that the reason that they were able to do this was because the Republicans controlled the House and the Senate too, and therefore had subpoena power. And the president has had a sort of fairly blessed 5 years because obviously the Republicans control the House and Senate, and they're not about to investigate anything seriously except for things like steroids in sport. courts. And until there's a change in the House, there's no likelihood that there'll be any serious investigations. But given that landscape that I've just laid out, does it strike you, John Dean, as a major irony that the only investigation that has been launched now has the deputies to the president and the vice president, arguably the second most powerful people in the land, in their crosshairs?
Well, excuse me. Obviously, if there was an independent counsel law, it would have been triggered a long time ago. And you would have an independent counsel had that law still been in existence. It expired. Yeah. It expired because both Republicans and Democrats had been sufficiently gored by the law that they don't want it.
Right, and ironically, Bill Clinton had a chance to expire and sunset that law, and he didn't, to his eternal chagrin.
That's exactly right. It's a shame. The law actually has some redeeming features, but what's happened is it got so politicized by the ability of the Congress to trigger these investigations on the slightest whim, and really, they're like the equivalent of putting a strike force on top of a federal official until you find them doing something wrong. And I've had many prosecutors tell me, "You give me enough time, enough money, I'll find an offense by anybody. Somebody's going to make a mistake sooner or later," and that's just not healthy. These people are not there for life. They are they're turned over every 4 or 8 years maximum. So it's just quite unusual to have that law. But anyway, the fact that the special counsel is now investigating the White House doesn't surprise me in the slightest. In fact, I think they're lucky. Indeed, as you, in the landscape you laid out, had there been a divided government, had there been a difference in the control of either the House or the Senate and 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, you can bet that there would be investigations going. In fact, that's probably the greatest jeopardy that the Bush administration faces, is if they lose control of the Senate in 06. It's going to be a very, if that happens, it's going to be a disastrous end of this presidency because they are vulnerable.
So you think that we're not even talking about the tip of the iceberg here.
I think we're seeing the tip of the iceberg, and it's just indicative of the way they've operated. I think they've got a host of problems they want to bury, and they've got, for example, several posts that aren't being confirmed because of the problems with these people being involved in the writing and preparation of torture guidelines.
That you're referring to the people that are actually replacing. Comey was replaced by Margolis, but there are two important positions in the Justice Department that are open, and one of the candidates is also tied up with the Jack Abram office, isn't he not?
That's correct. That's another Irishman by name of Flanagan, who's got 14 children, who needs work, maybe. and he's the new designated Deputy Attorney General.
Yeah, well, I think his wife needs a rest by the sound of it. So the other investigation, John Dean, that's not getting a lot of attention, and I'm not sure that it necessarily connected, is the investigation into AIPAC, where the FBI have charged a Pentagon official, Larry Franklin, but they've also indicted two officers with AIPAC, Rosen and Weissman. And in what we've seen in terms of what's been released to the press is the names of, not the names, but the designations of people inside the government that are connected to this investigation, namely USGO, U.S. Government Official 1 and 2. So how would you rate that in terms of this landscape of how much the Bush administration have skated by?
Well, I think the entire Defense Department contracting operation in Iraq is another of these great vulnerabilities these people have. There has been a lot of quick money made over there, a lot of dubious accounting, a lot of questionable government contracts, and they've sort of overwhelmed the Department of Justice and their own internal investigative processes, where it's not really been possible to have accounting. So Someday this is all going to shake out. The question will be whether it happens before Bush gets out of town or after.
Meanwhile, $6 billion a month is what the bill is. It's like the world's the ultimate taximeter that's ticking away here.
It's awesome.
It's awesome, and there isn't any oversight. And some of these companies like Custer Battles are so flagrant that it's breathtaking that they're even still over there. And the rumor is, of course, that the Bush administration, the military, are in something of a silent revolt now about wanting to get out of Iraq. So it's not inconceivable that they'll still keep the $6 billion a month gravy train growing, and they'll simply privatize the war effort over there with more and more contractors.
Very, very possible. You'll have soldiers of fortune over there.
Exactly.
Who will take up the slack, and the taxpayer will just pay for it, and it won't be, it'll be American treasure, but not American blood.
Right. Well, they
voluntarily go over there to fight.
Exactly, and this is an unusual situation where they have a direct conduit into the treasury. It seems. But just in closing, John Dean, what you mentioned earlier, you alluded earlier to the Saturday Night Massacre, where President Bush, President Nixon, faced with mounting problems with the Watergate, fired Archibald Cox. Given that President Bush is joined at the hip with Karl Rove, and his loyalty, Bush's loyalty to his insiders is legendary, is it not therefore inconceivable that if it came to a choice that Bush had a choice between firing Rove or firing Patrick Fitzgerald, that he would fire Fitzgerald before he fired Rove?
Well, there's a third option, too, is to pardon Rove, like his father did with Weinberger.
But don't you normally pardon when you leave office? I mean,
you can pardon any time.
I see.
You could pardon, you know, if you're a lame duck in the last months or last years of your presidency, and you just say, "Hey, I don't think what he did was criminal. It was a mistake, and I'm chastising him, but I'm not going to send him to jail."
So it's just a the woodshed routine, right?
Right, but of course that would have repercussions. But what this administration has shown is how short-lived the repercussions are. You can march the country to war, and nobody really cares. Yes, there are a few people in Crawford, Texas. The woman who's, you know, you're following on your own show is protesting, but there's not a widespread movement at this point. Even though the poll numbers show that Americans are disgusted with a war.
Well, it is. It's a strange universe. It's also a strange universe in terms of the military. If it's true that what I hear, that the generals, the staff are upset, at the same time, you know, the people who are behind the black eye that this country's got over torture, they seem to be skating, and whereas some general who had an affair with a woman, and he's, you know, it's not as if the guy is not even married, I don't think.
Yes, I saw Ariana's post on that, which I thought was very good, where she made that point. We're sending, you know, we promote people who encourage torture, and we can people who get into extramarital affairs. There is a disconnect there, but it's this strange world we're living in, where you have only partial public interest in what's going on. You don't have widespread public interest, and the elites have not found it sufficient to be annoyed with Bush to come down on him.
Well, perhaps we're moving into a cultural landscape where we have access to all information and knowledge about nothing.
That's well put.
I thank you for joining us, John Dean.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hello again. I'm Ian Masters. We're just speaking then with John Dean, who served as President Nixon's White House lawyer for 1,000 days. He was later became the star of the Watergate hearings. He wrote about that experience in two books, Blind Ambition and Lost Honor. He's also written The Rehnquist Choice, The Untold Story of the Nixon Appointment That Redefined the Supreme Court. And his newest book is Worse Than Watergate, The Secret Presidency of George W. Bush. And we're talking about the status, as much as one can find out, about the independent counsel Fitzgerald's investigation into the outing of Valerie Plame, the CIA officer who was outed in response to an op-ed piece her husband wrote in the New York Times, critical of the run-up to the Gulf War. I'm now speaking with Philip Giraldi, who was for 17 years a CIA operations officer specializing in counterterrorism. He served in Europe and the Middle East. He now works in the private sector doing security consulting, and he writes a column in the American Conservative on international security issues. A recent column that he wrote focusing on Iran and the attention that the White House has given, and of course, just this weekend, President Bush appearing on Israeli television suggested that the option, a military option against Iran in terms of preempting their attempts to develop a nuclear weapon was on the table. In this column that Philip Giraldi wrote, he notes that Vice President Cheney had tasked STRATCOM to develop a plan of attack utilizing conventional and nuclear forces or nuclear weapons, tactical nuclear weapons against Iran. Philip, are you with me?
Yes, I am.
Thanks for joining us. And let me ask you then, what was your reaction to the President given an opportunity to kind of, you know, calm things down a little bit, made that inflammatory statement on, of all venues, Israeli television? It's prompted some of the allies, and particularly the Germans, to gasp. What was your reaction?
Well, my reaction was that it's not particularly inflammatory in the sense that it's only the latest in a series of consistent statements that have come out of the White House and out of the Department of Defense that have basically put the military option on the table with Iran, and I believe this is very clearly the intention of the administration.
But it seems to be counterintuitive. If you were trying to split the Iranian people from the mullahs, and for a while back there, before these last elections, there was indications of tremendous sort of seething dislike for this clerical, corrupt clerical regime. But now there's been an election in Iran that has turned things around, and you can't help feeling that, in fact, it's the presence of our army on their border and the kind of belligerent talk coming out of the White House that is driving the Iranian people into the embrace of the mullahs.
Well, you have to consider two things in terms of what you're saying. The first is that the election in Iran was not necessarily a reaction. It was to a certain extent, but you also have to realize that the eventual winner wasn't on many levels a reformist candidate in terms of corruption. The second thing is that when George Bush speaks on Israeli television, he's essentially speaking to an American audience. He's not interested in what the impact is on Iran. He's essentially creating a case, just as the case was made against Iraq prior to the invasion of Iraq.
So you see parallels here with the buildup.
I see a very precise parallel. There's been a lot of saber rattling going on about Iran, and this has, for example, at the AIPAC annual conference 2 months ago, the principal theme of the conference was Iran and the threat posed by Iran. So there's a consistent pattern in terms of creating a case for using force against Iran.
But this also, given that the paucity of real reality in the build-up to the Iraq war in terms of WMD and the changing narrative all the time, and I think that's one of the reasons why this mother who's demonstrating down in Crawford has some traction. The bottom line is that that the White House itself never got a story straight about why we went into Iraq, and still appears to be trying to grasp a consistent narrative. That's not to say that the Democrats in the last election weren't able to create any kind of alternative narrative.
Well, I mean, look, let's face it, the Democrats are worse. I mean, they're calling for more troops in Iraq as a solution. The whole issue is that the Iraq war was from the start a fiction, and the reason for going into Iraq there were numerous reasons for going into Iraq, but none of them were reasons that really impacted on the American national interest, and there was no reason for us to do so. The same game is kind of being played out with Iran. Iran quite genuinely is a more serious threat. And certainly there should have been diplomatic solutions that should have been pursued vis-a-vis Iran starting perhaps 3 or 4 years ago.
Well, but the long and the short of it is that our intervention in Iraq has handed Iran a bloodless victory. We have removed Iran's two problems. On one border, the Taliban, who they almost went to war with, and on the other border, Saddam Hussein. So the mullahs have got to be sort of chuckling to themselves, saying, you know, God bless you, the great Satan.
Well, and you might add to that the fact that the Minister of Defense of the Iraqi government recently was in Tehran working out a modus vivendi, if you will. So they're, what you're saying is true, and it is even truer.
So, in other words, people like Scowcroft and General Odom and others who warned that this was a strategic blunder, in effect, having made a strategic blunder on that level, there is really no way out, is there? There's no way you can win it because it's doomed from the outset.
I would suspect that that's correct. I mean, there obviously is a way out. The way out is out. And at this point, the option should be, which George Bush is wrestling with his limited rhetoric, is that leaving is the solution.
But let's look at Philip Giraldi, if we can, how much we have emboldened and strengthened Iran in this kind of blunder in order to go after Iraq. We've strengthened Iran. It seems to me that some people in the region refer to it as the Shia moment. Mm-hmm. And my fear about Iraq is that it has already become a surrogate war to the extent that the Saudis and the Gulf Arabs and others are supporting the Sunni insurrection because they see the writing on the wall. They call it the Shia Crescent, where Iran extends its influence across Iraq and Syria, we know, is like a low-hanging fruit that's about to collapse any rate from its own internal corruption. Mm-hmm. And then you have the Iranian presence in Lebanon, and of course the Shia regime, the Alawites run Syria. So there's that notion that they have a corridor into the Mediterranean, which goes back to the Emperor Darius. So how much do you think that is a real thing, and how much is it? Is it provoking the Sunni insurrection?
Well, I think that the what you're saying is all absolutely correct. I mean, the fact is that there is a Shiite crescent building up in the region. There's not a whole lot we can do about it because basically we've allowed the Iraqi government, such as it was under Saddam Hussein, to collapse, leading to this situation in which the numbers and the other political realities have basically borne fruit. The whole issue for us is we have a strategic interest in the Middle East, which is basically about oil. And they keep dodging the bullet on oil and discussing oil, but that's really what it's all about. It's up to us to establish a system in the Middle East whereby we have access to the oil and essentially are somewhat disengaged from the politics.
But the reverse is true. If you take Mao Zedong's dictum that the idea is to have hegemony without responsibility, if we went in there to secure oil, to bring democracy, to get rid of bad guys, and to get rid of the portent of weapons of mass destruction, on all counts, it seems the opposite is true. When you're paying $3 a gallon now for gasoline out here in California.
Yeah, okay, but I mean the point is that if you accept the fact that the terrorist movement against us is largely motivated by our political presence in the region, then when you remove the physical presence, you suddenly change the equation. And there are certainly lots of reasons to assume that we can deal with the Iranians on a business level, just as we can deal with anyone else.
But if we're to follow what's happening with the White House and what's happening with Vice President Cheney, it seems to me that, are you suggesting they're bluffing by drawing up attack plans against Iran?
No, I don't think they're bluffing at all, and this is the scary thing. I think that the fact is that the White House believes that you can basically influence very complicated geostrategic issues purely through the application of military force. I believe that what we've seen in Iraq has proven that that's not correct. There are more complicated, there are more subtle ways to deal with these issues, and that's basically what we should be doing. But that's not where the White House is at.
But if they do, and it's hard to believe that they could even entertain these ideas, given how their plate is full in Iraq, and that Iran has far more leverage over us to cause us grief than we have against them, even though perhaps a comprehensive bombing attack against their facilities would be damaging. They nevertheless, you know, they have the result of creating Iranian nationalism and having people rally around the flag. But on the other hand, think about how much the Iranians can cause us further grief in Iraq. We have a Sunni insurgency that's taking place and killing our boys and girls. But the Shia insurgency hasn't begun because the Iranians are largely telling them to cooperate with the Americans, because the Americans are, after all, killing their next enemy. So don't you think the Iranians have much more leverage to cause us grief than we them?
I agree with you absolutely. And I think that your analysis is correct. The mindset of the White House clearly is that a surgical air attack against Iran, possibly including tactical nuclear weapons, would be a way of eliminating Iran's nuclear threat. Now that's the mindset. Now whether that is a practical way of looking at the situation or not is of course debatable, and I would debate that it's completely inaccurate. It would turn a country that has a great deal more capability to do a lot of mischief against us into an active enemy.
And also, the Iranians have their surrogates in Lebanon, Hezbollah, who would be unleashed, wouldn't they?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, and they have a great deal of influence also in the Palestinian areas. So it's this would basically create a extremely volatile situation for the United States.
Let me again remind the audience, if I may, I'm speaking with Philip Giraldi, who was for 17 years a CIA operations officer specializing in counterterrorism. He served in Europe and the Middle East, and he now works in the private sector consulting, and he writes a column for the American Conservative, and we're talking about a recent column where he talked about Vice President Cheney having tasked STRATCOM to develop a plan of attack against Iran utilizing conventional and tactical nuclear weapons.
The thing to bear in mind also about my column is that the issue is essentially that the plan is a way of getting at Iran without Iran necessarily being complicit in the terrorist attack. To me, that's the kind of, you know, Dr. Strangelove scary aspect of this.
So that's an echo of what they did in Iraq. Then.
Exactly. It's like if you're attacked by Osama bin Laden, you go after Saddam Hussein.
Well, given though that as I mentioned earlier, that Iran has capabilities to cause us perhaps more grief than we could cause them, and I mentioned the possibility of setting Hezbollah loose on the world stage and in Lebanon, where they are the de facto military power. What do you make of rumors, which I understand are coming out of the intelligence community, that perhaps Iran has already been flexing its muscles, and that the assassination of Hariri was not necessarily carried out by the Syrians, but perhaps by the Iranians via Hezbollah?
Well, I would suggest to you that in the Middle East, where you look for a smoking pistol, it's where the smoking pistol normally is. And in this case, I do believe that it was carried out by the Syrians, because the Syrians had an immediate objective in doing this, and it is totally characteristic of the way they've responded to perceived threats in the past. Now, we don't know exactly, you know, who did it, when they did it, how they did it, but I would strongly believe that if the evidence comes in, it will implicate Syria.
And the evidence is, of course, that the Syrians were running a mafia operation down there, where they were making, at least the secret police people and relatives of the Assads were making a fortune, right?
Well, yeah, that's part of it, but it was more complicated than that. The Hariri was challenging the whole legitimacy of the Syrian presence in the area, so there were other issues too.
But given that Syria is such a basket case, What's your expectation there? Because as much as we're saber-rattling against Iran, mm-hmm. which is, I think, a strong country, and we're underestimating its strength, and we're underestimating the nationalism there, isn't it true that on the Syrian side, it's just like I use the analogy of a sort of rotten, low-hanging fruit?
Yeah, but the point is, what at the end of the day is the threat of that Syria poses towards the United States' national interest? There's virtually none. Basically, in terms of the saber rattling towards Syria, we're acting as surrogates for the Israelis.
And just then, in closing, Philip Giraldi, I've been interested in following the other string of the Valerie Plame Joe Wilson story. You know, the string is being played out from starting when Wilson was sent to Niger by the CIA at the behest of the vice president, and he came back and said there's nothing to this, and then the president had his State of the Union where he mentioned Saddam trying to acquire uranium from Niger, and then Wilson wrote his op-ed piece, and then in retaliation, one assumes they outed his wife, and then the CIA made a criminal referral to the Justice Department, and a special counsel was appointed. And now the special counsel appears to have Karl Rove and Scooter Libby in his crosshairs, if you were to believe the leaks to the press. But if you play the string out from the other end, which is if you go back to the documents that they sent Wilson over there based upon, the so-called Niger documents, mm-hmm. I've been looking into that, and we know, at least the FBI seems to know, that those documents were forged here in the United States and somehow got to Italian intelligence. Do you think that the press is missing the bigger story here by following the string in that direction and not in the other direction, or is it a case where we really can't get to it because Senator Pat Roberts is sitting on this information?
Well, there's a combination of everything you've suggested. I mean, to me, the press is remarkably sycophantic vis-a-vis the Bush administration because all of the mainline press basically is dependent on the White House for handouts. But the fact is, I think when these indictments do come down, we will discover that two former CIA officers were the principal forgers of this document, and that a certain individual with close ties to the Italian intelligence services was the person who actually passed the material to the Italians. The Italians have investigated this from their end, and they've come to that conclusion also.
And would I be correct in identifying the person that I already identified?
He's quite a litigious gentleman, the name that you suggested, so I would refrain from possibly naming that.
Okay.
No. These are two senior officers, both of whom served in Italy, both of whom also served in Africa and the Middle East. One is dead now, the other one is still alive.
And I thought that the neocons hated the CIA. I didn't think they had any traction over there.
Well, actually, they do hate the CIA. They don't have much traction. It's kind of, there were, among some retired CIA officers, there are personal connections with individual neocons.
I see. And that's how this was carried out. But so the INC, the Iraqis, Chalabi's people didn't have a hand in the forgeries?
No.
I see.
No.
Well, I thank you for joining us and for filling us in a little bit on this story, which I take it you agree with me that this is a more important smoking gun in many ways.
Oh, absolutely. I think that, Dan, this is a story that potentially has feet.
Yeah.
And we shall see in the next, I think, couple months what will happen with it.
Because it basically comes down to the idea that our side, this administration, manufactured its own evidence to go to war.
Well, I think that's clear in general, and,
right.
And this is only one kind of subset of that.
But it's possibly the smoking gun.
Well, it could be.
I thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Philip Giraldi. He was for 17 years a CIA operations officer specializing in counterterrorism. He served in Europe and the Middle East, and he now works as a consultant and writes for the American Conservative. I'm now going to Crawford, Texas, to speak with Ann Wright, a former State Department official who resigned at the beginning of the Iraq War in March of 2003. And she has been at for 29 years. She's a veteran of the United States Army. And Ann, you are there in the, I believe it's very hot and dusty. And
not exactly. I'm sitting in the middle of a Texas cow field.
And
oh, Lord, we got cows on all sides of us. We've got... It's quite remarkable where we are, and watching hundreds of people pour into this place from all over the country to be here in support of Cindy Sheehan and her request to the president that he just talk to her about this war.
And the president, of course, is on a month-long vacation. He's taken 20% of his time in office has been taken in vacations, and this, I take it, is not your idea of the ideal vacation spot.
Well, I'll tell you what. We're out here. It's not nearly as hot here as it is in Iraq, and if those young men and women are over in Iraq, we can be here in hot Texas to protest that war and to say to get those kids out of that hot weather in Iraq and bring them home, stop the killing of Iraqis and stop the killing of, well, the U.S. is the target over there. And as long as our troops are there, you know, it'll never calm down. So I think Iraq had plenty of infrastructure before we interfered with it. There were plenty of professionals. They could handle their own affairs. The U.S. just needs to get out of the way. Stop the killing, stop the war.
And I take it, I mean, without putting words in your mouth, in fact, why don't I just ask you this? What were your reasons for quitting the State Department? Obviously, it coincided with that war, and you probably were doing your best inside the government to protest it. What was your misgivings in general? Because, earlier guests were talking about the fact that essentially it was a strategic blunder from which there was no retreat.
Well, my rationale for not going along with the war, and this is kind of interesting because I'd spent 29 years in the military, so it wasn't like I was unfamiliar with wars and going to war and all that. But the going to war without the UN Security Council resolution authorizing the international community to take action, or unless there was an imminent threat to the United States security, and to me there was none. I mean, here was Iraq after 12 years of being having an embargo on it, two no-fly zones. We knew every single thing that was going in and out of that country, and there was no humanitarian disaster other than what we were causing anyway through the application of sanctions. So I felt that going to war in an oil-rich Arab country was the recipe for world turmoil. It was not going to make the world safer. It was going to make it more dangerous. And it would create more young men and women in the Muslim and Arab communities that would continue to dislike us even more intensely for that action. So with all of that, I also had some misgivings about the lack of action on the Bush administration in trying to do anything to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian situation. No movement at all, and remember that was back in 2003, on the dangers from North Korea. In fact, the administration was just studying the problem. And then the unnecessary curtailment of civil liberties under the Patriot Act. And other than that, you know, I thought everything was just fine.
Well, it's interesting, Anne Wright, that you're talking about and it's very clear that we've created a hornet's nest in the Middle East, and Iraq has become a haven for terrorism and a training ground and a proving ground, and people are flocking in from particularly from Saudi Arabia and Syria and Jordan to join in the jihad. And the rest of the world obviously it disapproves, to put it mildly. But yet here in the United States, even though we are losing this war and it's an unwinnable war and it's nothing but a sucking wound that's destroying this country's good name in the world, not to mention thousands of lives of our young men and women in the service and hundreds of, perhaps even as much as 100,000 Iraqi civilians. Nevertheless, it doesn't seem to be resonating so much in the American body politics, certainly in the press. But my feeling is, I spoke with Cindy Sheehan last Sunday, that what she's doing there and what you're joining in there, Anne Wright, is actually perhaps the beginning of the American people finally engaging in what is happening in their name.
Well, is that the truth? I mean, who ever thought that one mother making the trip to hot old Crawford, Texas, in the middle of August? I mean, you talk about the worst time in the world to come to Texas. This is it. And yet her standing there and having hundreds, thousands of people coming in from all over this country. I mean, we are having people that are flying in for one day just to come down and show solidarity. We're having people that are driving 36 hours driving over here and then sleeping in their car in the ditch. We don't have any facilities here. We have ditches that we are in. And we sleep in the ditches, we eat in the ditches, we have our little posters in the ditches. I mean, this is one of the most uncomfortable places you have ever seen in your life, and yet thousands of people are coming here in support. And they're having vigils. They're creating their own, we call this one Camp Casey in honor of Cindy's son that was killed. There are many other families who have had loved ones killed, and you know, to honor that and yet say, we want this war to end. I mean, there ought to be Camp Ann's, Camp Jennifer's, Camp Tom's, Camp Whatever's, all over, because we've got 1,840-some-odd people that have now been killed. That plus, of course, we cannot forget the huge number of Iraqis that have been killed by our smart bombs, our this, our that, and there is a real disaster from the killing in Iraq. So there should be camps all over the world being set up to say, stop this killing in this war. There are better ways to do things than just go out and start wars. And this whole idea of I heard your previous interview about Vice President Cheney directing STRATCOM on this Iranian thing. My God, you know, people of America really need to take to the streets. This administration cannot allow them to even think about invading Iran. I mean, that is so off the charts. I mean, we ought to close down Washington. We ought to dump horse trucks full of manure on I-395. We ought to make sure our federal government does not work if they're thinking about stuff like that. They've gotten us into two wars right now, and we need to put a stop to this mess.
Well, are you implying, Ann Wright, that this demonstration inside of Crawford, when the president finishes his month-long vacation, it may travel with him back to Washington?
Well, I believe that's what Cindy said yesterday, that she'll stay here to the 31st when he leaves, and if he, when he goes, we follow the White House, I think is her term. If the White House goes back to Washington, they're going to find a Cindy Sheehan and all of the supporters of the premise of take back our own country, get our image back to the extent that we were admired in the world, but boy, now we are not. And we, the American people, have to take back our government, have to remake our image, and show the world that we will stop an administration that puts us into illegal, criminal wars.
And Ann Wright, obviously there are a number of people that oppose the war, and it's worth noting that in the last election, even though the Democratic candidate John Kerry didn't make a very coherent case, nevertheless he almost received a little under 50% of the vote. President has treated his victory as a mandate, but it clearly is not. So my question is, given that the blue states in this country have opposed this war and obviously are doing more so as it becomes manifestly a disaster and an unwinnable situation to, you know, any rational person should be able to see this. And even people like O'Reilly and the right-wing pundits on Fox News are beginning to question Rumsfeld's judgment, etc. Obviously, they don't want to go after their president because they're for all intents and purposes like the Pravda of the Republican Party. But on the other hand, give me a sense. There you are in Crawford, in a red state. Do you feel that people in the red states, and I don't mean to be glib about this blue-red divide, but it is a real dichotomy in this country, do you think that their minds are changing and that they are beginning to, their discomfort about this war is beginning to turn into political activism?
Well, I've been kind of startled and amazed at what's happened here. I thought we would be coming into a totally, totally hostile area. Coming to Crawford, the home of the president, although a lot of people in Texas says Texas is not the home of the president. But, you know, we've been treated with courtesy and respect. There have been very few instances where cars have come by and people have yelled rude things or made rude gestures. There have been protesters, and that's fine. But it's been peaceful protests or counter protests. The thing that's really amazed me has been the number of people who have indicated here, right in the heart of bushland, so to speak. I mean, they have been indicating that they are concerned. We've had two folks whose kids were killed who have come to the camp and have been initially very angry about these 500 crosses that have been brought here by, as a part of what's called Arlington West, brought here by Veterans for Peace here in Los Angeles. Pardon me.
Yeah, I know you get
all sorts of stuff in the background here.
Sure.
Traffic control of trying to have hundreds of people here in a tiny country road and not get them all run over by our own cars is challenging.
Sure.
But we've had people that we've been able to have talks with, one-to-one talks about, not about the politics of it all, but about the human costs. And those families have lost their loved ones. Our families that are here have gone to them and reached out to them and in a non-political way have, I think, made a difference in the lives of those grieving families. So on many levels, this is very, very important. Of course, we stand for stopping the war, but we also stand for reaching out to those families, no matter what their belief, whether the war should continue or not. But they are grieving families. There are 1,840-some-odd of them, and this organization of Gold Star Families and Military Families Speak Out want to reach grieving parents and grieving families. So we've made a lot of headway in talking with lots of people who need another way of support. So I'm just so thrilled to be here. I just can't imagine how heartening it is to see people from all over America. And we've had people that are from other parts of the world who've been vacationing in America who have made a specific detour in their travel schedules to come down here to see Americans finally standing up to their government on this war issue.
Well, the Associated Press's poll that just came out indicates that only 38% of the American people support President Bush's handling of the war, meaning 62% of the American people are against it. And you'd think that with that number, you'd have something to work with. And as I mentioned earlier, Ann Wright, it seems that Cindy Sheehan has in a way galvanized and started to create a coherent and simple and heartfelt narrative about why we should get out of this war. And in fact, she doesn't even say to get out of it war. She just says, President Bush, please tell me why my son died and what for. You know, her message is so much simpler and straight at the heart. But just let me change subject the last second a bit and suggest to you, Ann Wright, since you're a 29-year veteran of the United States Army, it seems to me the other area where there is a growing angst about this war is within the military itself. It seems that many of the general officers, Abizaid and others, and if you watch what's happening at the Pentagon now with Rumsfeld trying to redefine the war on terror as a struggle against extremism. Apparently, the army is basically saying to the White House, look, you know, this is unwinnable. You've put us in this situation. You know, we've rebuilt the United States Army after the all-time low at the end of the Vietnam War, and we've rebuilt this army, and now it's being shattered.
Well, that's right. And when the military itself, I mean, they've been signaling that in very specific terms for a couple of months now, but I think it's getting to the point, you know, that the Army generals themselves are finally the institution that they've grown up with, that they're professionals, and they serve all administrations, and they know that they are the ones that will guard our security under any administration. And when they see an administration misusing the military, although, I mean, Bush was elected, selected. He is in charge of our country. But when you have an administration that is purposely pushing plans that mean that the military is being destroyed, really, by these plans in an unwinnable situation, which they knew from the very beginning. You know, it's, when you go into a huge area like Iraq with a very small force, not even enough force to protect the institutions that you need to run the country if you're occupying, like protecting the water supply, the electrical supply, the sewage supply.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time, Anne. I'm sorry we have to cut it off here. We've run out of time. I thank you so much for joining us from Crawford, Texas,
well,
Anne Wright.
Come to Crawford. If you're sitting in Los Angeles, just sitting there listening to this, you are not participating in one of the most important events in America right now, so get on your horse, get on your bicycle, get on the plane, and come on to Crawford.
I thank you for joining us. Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, just speaking then with Anne Wright, who's down in Crawford, Texas, outside President Vacation Ranch, protesting. She's a former State Department official who resigned at the beginning of the Iraq War, and she's a 29-year veteran of the United States Army. I thank the producer, Louis Vandenberg, and Mark Maxwell, the engineer, and a special thanks, Mark, who's leaving us, unfortunately, for all of his years of great service, and we're going to miss him enormously. And I also thank Carol Coote and Rusty Wynn, the assistant producers. This program and all other programs are available at ianmasters.org.